It started again. And so we've again been looking at this communication system model, and we've now sort of gotten up to the point where we have a signal to transmit, and we're now assuming that that signal is going to be transmitted over a radio channel. And again, radio channels behave fairly differently to wires or fiber or sort of other types of channels. And so what we're going to have a look at today is the properties of the radio channels, and I'm not going to sort of delve into any of them in any depth, but we're going to look at what the issues are and sort of what we sort of see here about the channel characteristics will motivate then the design of cellular systems. So most of this can be found in Chapter 5 of Stallings, and the main issues are, well, we need to sort of have some basic terminology about antennas, at least. And so antennas would be the mechanism by which we send and receive our signal. There's sort of a number of ways of going about this. The one we're going to concentrate on, and this, again, is used in most of these systems, is a line of sight transmission. And then we will sort of look at all of the various properties of this sort of transmission. So firstly, like any signal, it's going to attenuate with distance. And we can characterize how radio signals attenuate. That tends to, again, be a little more complicated than for a wire. Specifically, you've got to take into account lots of things about the environment. Do you have a building in the way? Do you have sort of a mountain in the way? Are you moving? All of that's going to sort of factor into what sort of a signal you can send or receive. Okay, and mobility will sort of introduce its own specific problems. Okay, so I don't want to dwell overly much on antennas, but you know, do you need some idea of sort of what they do and sort of what's their basic flavors? And so for now we're going to assume that our antenna is sort of out in space somewhere. Nothing is blocking our signal. Nothing is going to cause any sort of additional problems. Even out in space with nothing blocking the signal still attenuates. Okay. And so we think of antennas as sort of having, they both transmit and receive signals. And we think of them as either not having a direction, in which case they're either called isotropic or omnidirectional, or what often suits our purposes better is to have something that is actually pointed in a specific direction and concentrating power in sending in a specific direction and focusing on receiving from a specific direction. Why? Because again, if you really do want to send signals in one direction, then you're able to sort of, again, have power gains by pointing the antennas. Okay. So to start with, we can think of having just this sort of idealized antenna that is radiating power in all different directions. And so the power is, again, sort of moving out spherically. And so we can either talk about the overall power or the power density, so power in sort of specific directions. Okay. And there's not exactly any physical implementation of this ideal radiate in all directions type of antenna. We'll see there are ways of approximating it. More typically, or I shouldn't say more typically, but commonly, the antennas are going to sort of concentrate the power into a specific direction. So the directivity is a measure of sort of the increase in power, again, in a very in a specific direction. Okay. And we're not going to worry overly much about how we get this directivity, but we'll just characterize the directivity as an antenna gain. So we'll say that we can boost power a certain amount by pointing it in a certain direction. Okay. So again, instead of having a spherical distribution of the power, your power is sort of concentrated in a certain portion of the of this three-dimensional space. And the back lobes essentially represent the fact that you can't completely direct your power. Okay. So, you could spend a whole course dealing with antennas. Again, we're just going to sort of get a few basics and move on from there. Our flavors are going to be omnidirectional, so broadcasting in 360 degrees. Sectorized, so broadcasting in some wedge of that 360. And again, we're talking really more about 360 in a parallel plane, not a spherical. So getting a circle rather than a sphere, usually. Sectorized will give you sort of a slice of that circle, and a panel will then concentrate your power in a specific direction. Okay. Now, we're going to mention two types of antennas. The first is dipole antennas. And the dipole antennas essentially give you this omnidirectionality. They don't give you a sphere. They give you a donut or a circle. So, again, if you think of just being in a certain space, you really don't need it radiating up to the ceiling. What you need is it going out along the surface of the Earth. And so by not, again, radiating in all directions, but rather radiating somewhat, in a plane, you can, again, get a gain. So you can regard as gain as either for the same power of transmission, you're getting more in a specific direction, or for sort of a fixed power in a direction, you don't need as much to achieve that power. Okay. And these dipole antennas are actual antennas. They can be built, not just, again, the theory of an isotropic antenna. Okay, and depending on the sort of length of the antenna, you can get slightly different patterns. So again, your dipoles, your half wave, you would get something very donut-like. If you take other fractions of your wave, you can again get something that's closer to your ideal isotropic antenna. But yeah, so the basic idea is again that you want your power radiating sort of away from you, horizontal to the Earth's surface. Okay, so that's giving you your omnidirectional antennas. Another option again is to focus your power in a very specific direction. And so this can be achieved by parabolic antennas, so dishes, essentially, with a curved surface. Okay. And so for a parabolic antenna, you're going to have a locus or focus, and you transmit from that focus, and the power that's radiated is all sent off in one direction. And similarly, if you receive in from that direction, the power coming in is going to be concentrated at that focus point. Okay. And this is all based on, well, the mathematics of a parabola, which says it's constructed by taking equidistant points between some line called the directrix and some point called the focus. And doing that again, you provide a curve of a certain shape, and that's in terms of bouncing off, reflecting off that curve, will direct energy towards the focus or away from the focus in sort of one direction. Okay, so again, it's possible to produce antennas that radiate sort of uniformly in a plane anyway, and maybe in a sphere. We can approximate a sphere. And it's also possible to produce antennas that sort of point in a specific direction. Okay. For our purposes, all we care about in characterizing antennas is the gain. And the gain, again, refers to the increase in power in a specific direction relative to sort of our ideal isotropic antenna. Okay, and this is a number that can be calculated for an antenna based on the effective area of the antenna, where the effective area, again, is dependent on what type of antenna and what shape it is. And we're not going to worry about it. You can look it up in a table or whatever. And then that effective area factors into the gain, and note that the gain is going to be dependent not just on the effective area, but on the wavelength of your signal. Okay. And just as a side, we can translate between a wavelength and a frequency. Okay, so the two are related frequency is the speed of light divided by your wavelength. Okay. Now, when the signal is traveling, it can travel along three possible paths. Yeah. And again, you have to produce the system that will do this. You can have a ground wave, which follows the curve of the Earth. And an example, probably the major example of that is AM radio. And because it's following the contour of the Earth, you can get long distances in transmission. Sky waves bounce off the Earth's surface and the atmosphere or the ionosphere. And so, again, they will give you long distances. Line of sight now is just exactly that. You have to the signal is traveling more or less in a straight line, and so you have to be able to you can't follow the curves of the Earth. Okay, and there are some factors that will impact on exactly how far you can reach with line of sights. And they have to have relatively high frequency signals. Okay. Now, line of sight is what is used in our radio systems, primarily when I'm talking about the radio systems are used for networks, for either your cellular networks or your other networks, and so they're what we're going to concentrate on. And what we're going to look at is all the factors which affect, or I shouldn't say all, some of the factors which affect the quality of your radio channel for such systems. Okay, and I already said that, you know, even if you're out in the middle of space transmitting a signal, it's still going to attenuate with distance. So even under ideal circumstances, your signal decreases. And in point of fact, if you're, you know, on good old planet Earth and in the middle of a city with your mobile, then there's a lot of additional factors that are going to potentially increase this attenuation and perhaps adds distortion of your signal as well. Okay. And basically, again, what you need to do is to send your signal at sort of sufficient power that the received signal, the power of the received signal, is still enough to overcome noise factors. Okay. And so we're going to start by looking at our simple model, just free space loss. So if we didn't have, if we were in a vacuum, what would happen? And then we're going to sort of add in some of these factors. Additionally, mobility will add its own complications and can make some of these factors either harder to predict or, indeed, worse. Okay. There's sort of two flavors of models, depending on what you want to do. Again, one option is to just use your free space loss model, and typically this is what we're going to do. If you want a very detailed picture of loss in a system, then the models become quite complex. Typically, a lot of times you have to actually gather data. You have to just look at what happens and curve fit based on that data. Okay, so what are the problems? Again, signal attenuation. Is a problem because if your signal decreases too much in power, you won't be able to decode it at the other end, specifically, either in the presence of noise or just the sort of sensitivity of your receiver. So you have to sort of get the signal to the receiver at a certain power level. Distortion can be even more problematic. And one cause is that, again, attenuation varies according to frequencies, so you'll have different attenuation factors along different frequencies. And, they can be accounted for to some extent, or just sending bits as opposed to analog signals tends to take care of that problem anyway. Okay. So, we transmit at a certain power level, and then the signal is received at another power level, sort of a lower power level. And so we can, again, in a vacuum, we can say that the decrease is a function of the distance squared. Okay. It's also a factor of your antenna characteristics, the wavelength you're transmitting at. But if you fix all of these, power decreases with the distance squared. And so this is the simplest model of loss that we can come up with. Okay. So, again, we can either talk about this ratio, or again, this ratio is important enough that we name it. We have our loss, which is the ratio of the received power to the transmitted power. And naturally, we can characterize that in terms of, we can characterize it in terms of decibel gains and losses as well. Okay. Now, in general, our loss is going to be a factor. We have our free space loss. We also have additional losses due to the environment that we're in. If we're not in a vacuum, if we're in air instead, you get some additional loss. Again, if you're standing in the middle of a city with signals bouncing off buildings everywhere, you get more loss. Loss that's potentially harder to predict. Okay. So, another thing that is commonly done is that we normalize our powers relative to the power at a fixed distance, D0. Okay, so essentially what that's going to do is it eliminates the transmitter power, just it folds it into this power at the fixed distance, D0. Okay, and again, this power is dropping at D squared from the receiver. We can, again, eliminate that actual transmitter power term in this way. Now, typically, D0 is characterized either if you're indoors, it's used, 1 meter is taken. If you're outdoors, 1 kilometer is used. Okay, and we'll sort of return to that later. Again, the reason why power is important is because of, well, 2 reasons, noise, and, you know, again, you have to keep your power levels relative to your noise levels high enough, and also, again, just the sensitivity of your receiver. For radio channels, there are 4 major categories of noise. Thermal noise, which is just sort of atmospheric noise. And that is a function of the signal bandwidth. So the greater the bandwidth, the more noise you experience. And the temperature. So the greater the temperature, the more noise. Okay. This is the white noise that you typically think of as noise. Other categories of noise are intermodulation noise. So this is interference from other signals. Okay, so we think of them as having a fixed bandwidth, but yeah, you know, those bandwidths typically spill over a bit. And so any spillover is experienced by other signals as noise. Again, crosstalk, picking up other signals, even if they're potentially not even at different frequencies. And then impulse noise, which is just sort of spikes in noise. Which are of short duration and pretty much you can't do much about. Okay, so again, we know that noise is going to have an impact on the amount of data that we're going to be able to send and to be able to decode. Now, what we had, again, was we had our loss had the terms of the free space loss, and then this additional loss term that we didn't say much about. And so what we're going to look at now is not even sort of all the causes of this additional loss term, but sort of one potential cause of loss, and that's the idea of multipath signals. And so, again, if you're out in space, then the signal is sent to you, and you receive it, and there's pretty much nothing in between. If you're in the atmosphere, well, you know, the signal's going to degrade a bit more, but there's still sort of nothing specific blocking it. If you're in sort of just anywhere standing on Earth, then there are going to be objects around you, and these objects can block the signal, and they can also cause the signal to bounce off of them. Okay, so if you're the car here and you're communicating with a base station, well, you get the direct signal, and that's fine, but in addition, you get other signals which resulting from the transmission bouncing off objects around you. Okay. And so you've got in multiple signals, and this causes a number of problems. First and foremost, the phase of these signals is going to vary, and this can cause either an amplification of the signal or, more likely, a reduction or an attenuation of the signal. Okay. Also, again, if you get the bounces far enough away, then the signals are not arriving at the same time at all, and you can have inter-signal interference potentially as well. We're going to concentrate for the moment on the first of these problems, which is just that we're getting different versions of our signal coming to us at different phase offsets. And characterizing this exactly is complicated, okay? And if you want to, if you just think about this scenario, then, well, think about the car being stationary. We would still need to characterize sort of each of the different paths along which the signal could travel. And if you have two objects they can bounce off of, then that's three signals to contend with. The more objects they can bounce off of, the more signals you have to contend with. So even just writing anything down is going to be complex. We'll look at an example where we have specifically one object to bounce off of, so we're getting a direct signal and then one bounced signal. And again, we look at this to see what impact that has on the received power. Okay. So, again, we're going to normalize our power just relative to the power at a certain distance. All that does is allow us to take it out of the equation, essentially. It's just the constant now. And just based on free space loss, we know that our power is dropping with e squared. The problem now is that, well, if you have one signal, you don't really need to worry about the phase of the signal. There's chalk somewhere. There's chalk. Okay, so if you have one signal, you just have a sinusoid, and the power is just going to be taken by sort of squaring that, averaging it, etc. If you have multiple signals now, you've got to consider how are the signals combining. If the second signal is coming in phase, well, that's great. You're actually going to have higher power. If the second signal is coming in out of phase, then you're in trouble. Okay, you're going to cancel out your signals. Now, in general, you're going to be somewhere in between those two cases. In order to deal with this, we represent our sinusoid as, like, we either think of it as a phasor or just a complex exponential. And so we see we have our phase, we have a phase term and a frequency term. Again, these frequency terms are the same no matter what. The phase is going to be different depending on the path by which the signal travels. Okay. And in particular, for any fixed frequency, our phase is a function of the frequency and the distance. And obviously, if we look at our two paths, the distance is going to be different. Okay. So now our received power is a function of, again, the distance squared, but now with our phase terms factored in. Okay. So what we need to do is to come up with some expression for 1 over d1 e to the j minus phi 1 minus 1 over d2 e to the j minus phi 2, or sorry, e to the j phi 2. Okay. And so we can get terms for d1 and d2. And again, that's just a sort of trigonometric thing, a geometric thing. And what we observe is that if D is large, so if we're long distance from our tower relative to the height of the tower, then we can say that the lengths of paths D1 and D2 are more or less the same. Okay, so that gets rid of the D1 and D2 terms. We can just pull them out as D. Now the problem is that we can't do that for the phase. We have to look at the little differences for the phase. And so we need to calculate our phase difference, delta phi, and that, again, is just going to be a function of the difference in the distances traveled. That's obvious enough. Okay. And so we can figure out what the differences are. And so we know what we can write down what D1 is, what D2 is. And using the Taylor expansion. And then we take the difference there. And we get that it's a function of the height of the two antennas and the distance. Okay. Plugging that delta phi term in, and then observing that delta phi is going to be pretty small. Again, the H1 and H2 terms are small, quite small relative to D. We can approximate our exponential as 1 minus J delta phi. And if we do that, then our term becomes just delta phi squared. Okay. And plugging in, we get our received power relative to our transmitted power. And now this is a factor not of d squared, but of d to the fourth. Okay. So by just considering two different signals, we see that our power is significantly reduced. Okay. Now, in our real world setting, this becomes incredibly much more complex. We have signals reflecting off a number of objects. Signals can also bend around objects, so that's diffraction. Signals sort of hit an object and split into multiple different trajectories. And again, just if signals are traveling significantly different amounts of distances, they're going to be time delayed as well. And this all combines to make it very difficult to predict the exact power level of the received signal. Typically, people just throw up their hands and characterize it quite crudely by saying that we know power is dropping as some factor of the distance, and we'll just choose a factor, typically somewhere between 2, which is our ideal case, and 5.5. Okay. And so, again, if you sort of choose it close enough, you're going to be okay. Now, so far, when I've shown this picture, well, I've shown it with a car, something that moves, but I haven't said what happens with motion. I've just said, you know, if you're in one place, then, you know, your signal's bouncing around and sort of getting attenuated in some hard-to-understand way. But the hard-to-understand way, which we're going to characterize fairly simply. Mobility adds extra problems. Okay. So, typically, what mobility does is it changes your setting. So, you have this very complex setting, and then because you're moving, that setting is changing, so you get additional fluctuation in that power level. If you're sitting one place, the power level might not be that easy to sort of mathematically calculate, but you could think about, imagine just measuring it, and, you know, that would be fine. If you're moving, then every time you move, that equation is changing. Okay. So, typically, the impacts of motion are characterized in terms of fast fading, which is sort of local disturbances, and slow fading, which is, again, the change that happens as you sort of completely change your terrain. So again, if you're moving amongst a bunch of buildings, then you have an effect just because the bounces are, you know, as you move, the bounces are hitting you in a different way, so that's fast fading. But at some point, maybe you move from the city to the country, and the whole scenario changes, and that's slow fading. Okay. Additionally, typically, not all, the impact on transmission is dependent on the frequency of the signal, and so in some cases you might have a case where all frequencies are affected equally, and in other cases some frequencies are more impacted than others. Okay. So again, you can either think of things that are large changes just in terrain, or smaller changes in terrain. And again, interestingly, if you have a lot of obstacles, then potentially there is no line of sight, in the sense that there's something's in the middle of that line of sight. And in that case, your receiver is depending on the sort of reflected signals and dispersed signals to actually get the signal at all. Okay. And so, again, additionally to that, you have fluctuations caused by sort of small-scale bouncing. So you either have the large-scale bouncing or small-scale, so local to the buildings. And that's going to create more rapid fluctuations. Okay. Additional to, again, just the change, the fluctuations in transmission, both on a sort of large and small scale. Again, if you're considering signals traveling along a number of paths, then if the sort of difference in distance of the paths is great enough, then there's going to be enough of a signal delay that one signal a signal traveling along one path may arrive at the same time as the next signal traveling along a different path, or the previous signal traveling along a different path. And so in this case, again, it's going to be hard to sort out which signal is valid. So again, if you think of, you're sending a stream of signals, one goes along a relatively short path, the other travels a longer path, and so potentially different signals can arrive at the same time. Okay, so what's the sort of overall effect of all this? And again, it's messy. You have sort of, as a function of distance, your signal is varying sort of rapidly, sort of locally, and also sort of at a more slow pace due to, again, gross changes in terrain. Yeah, and that's all going to be built on top of your free space loss. So it's a very complicated picture of sort of how loss occurs. And what you need to do, or what a receiver needs to do, is essentially be able to cope with not only these sort of gross changes, but also the very quick instantaneous changes. Okay. And so, ideally, you have a receiver that's sensitive enough to deal with the worst case that you might encounter. Okay, so again, it's complicated to predict. To some extent, what you want to do is sort of arrive on what's the worst case scenario and deal with that. A lot of work has gone into coming up with loss models, and again, it's very difficult to determine analytically. So again, if you think of the paths and trying to represent each portion of the path, and then trying to represent the variability in the path, etc., it's not something you're going to easily write down. I mean, there is work that goes into, particularly in sort of more enclosed, predictable settings, writing all that down, but it's complicated. Okay, a second approach is to look at empirical data, so to go out and measure power levels at various places, and then try and curve fit that, so try and plug that into some sort of mathematical formula. Okay. And what we're going to have a brief look at here is three models that do just that. The Lee model is one of the simpler ones. And again, it was based on a bunch of data from a city in the U.S. And it came up with a relatively low number of parameters and a relatively simple equation based on those parameters. The Okamura model, again, gathered a lot of data, this time in Tokyo, and came up with a much more complex and detailed representation of the loss, although again, boiling down to a relatively small number of parameters. And then the Hata model extended the Okamura model by essentially making it, we'll see how it extended it. Okay, now the drawback of all of these models is that they are based on one set or a few sets of empirical data. So you look at one city, and then you look at Los Angeles, then you say, well, I want to apply that to New York. It may or may not work. Or think of Tokyo. Tokyo is a fairly low city. So there's a lot of building, but it's all fairly low. How does that apply to New York, where there's skyscrapers everywhere? Okay, so there is, you have to use a bit of caution when trying to apply these models to other scenarios. Okay. So again, the Lee model took a bunch of measurements of a U.S. city, and then attempted to characterize the power at a specific distance. And so we have our base power, and we have that then our, essentially this is our attenuation term, and you have to decide what gamma should be, and than a factor that's accounting for frequency, the frequency of transmission. So again, we've said that, you know, depending on the frequency, the power received is different. And finally, this sort of fudge factor, F0, which is going to try and lump together everything else that might impact on our transmission. Okay. And so P0 and gamma are picked according to sort of just basic measurements, and again, they're matched to different types of environments. So everything from free space to suburban to urban environments. Okay. And so again, the frequency term is straightforward enough, although, I don't know why I didn't do it for, anyway, so if you look at the frequency term, the choice now is for this parameter N, and again, N is chosen differently for different environments. And finally, we have this fudge factor, which accounts for antenna gain, antenna heights, etc. So, you know, again, you can see that there is a way to parameterize this for different environments, but yeah, you know, you have to be careful when doing that. Okay. The Okamura model is another model. It's one of the most widely used models for predicting signal strength. And again, it's based on empirical measurements in Tokyo. And it gives a sort of more detailed characterization of the power loss. And again, you have a number of factors. Including the free space loss, gains based on your antenna heights, and attenuation based on frequency and attenuation factor based on frequency and distance. And finally, again, a fudge factor of a gain of area due to environment. Now, what Okamura did was he did a quite detailed mapping of these fudge factors, if you will. Okay. And so instead of just writing down an equation, you have a series of charts which give you these corrective factors. Okay, and again, those are all gotten based on the empirical data. Okay. The antenna height gains are given in terms of a formula, and potentially those can be sort of further characterized, again, according to terrain, etc. Okay. So what you have is quite detailed information about sort of what factors are impacting on the attenuation and how. The drawback is that it's very difficult. You have to go to all these different charts to actually sit down and calculate it. Okay, so there is an example here. You can work through it yourself. It's, you know, again, just plugging numbers into these various factors, looking at the charts in the when necessary. Okay, the last model is the Hatta model, which does curve fitting essentially on the Akamura plots. So it moves the plots back into a mathematical formula, which again allows things to be calculated more easily. Okay, and so you have a number of correction factors, and the factors again are going to depend on what terrain you're in. Okay, so it's going to be different for urban, suburban, etc. Okay. And so, you know, it goes on, it keeps people very busy sort of refining and improving on these models. Now, again, they can certainly give a very good sort of general picture of what's going on, but they are based on sort of very specific terrains, and then sort of you extrapolate from there, and it's, you have to use care when sort of concluding that it applies to a different setting. Okay, so the final topic that I'm going to mention in terms of channels is the matching of the channel bandwidth and sort of, we've said that a lot of these effects sort of impact different frequencies differently. So how do we match the channel characteristics over the entire frequency spectrum relative to the bandwidth at which you're going, the spectrum at which you're transmitting your signal? Okay. And so we're going to take just quick examples of sort of a narrow band, medium band, and wide band system. So, again, what you can think of is potentially at certain frequencies you're going to have very bad attenuation, but we know that sort of fluctuates. Now, if we have a narrowband signal, then the impact of that fluctuation is going to be influenced by, well, sort of, is that fluctuation hitting exactly where your carrier frequency or not? Okay. And so if it's not hitting your carrier frequency, you're fine. If it is hitting your carrier frequency, you're sad. Okay. Now, as you expand the bandwidth, well, you are going to hit some of your
you are going to hit some of these attenuation points. But again, if you make clever use of your modulation, then you should be able to compensate. Okay. Now, as the frequency, sort of as the bit rate increases, sort of the duration of bits drops, and so symbol interference becomes more of an issue. And again, as you go into a wideband system, you have you're going to find sort of more of these maxima and minima, and potentially a greater impact of delay. And again, you need to be cleverer and cleverer about how you recover your initial signal. Okay, so again, we can't just think of attenuation as happening at sort of a fixed, happening at a fixed amount, but again, within a single signal, you'll have different amounts of attenuation over your signal bandwidth. So there are a number of techniques for dealing with this, and they all fall under the heading of diversity reception. So trying to recover your initial signal. Okay. And so they're essentially just tricks you can use. Okay. There's so essentially what you want to do is you want to get a couple of signals and compare them. And in this case, you have, instead of having a single receiver, you have two or more receivers. And so they are separated sufficiently that hopefully the fading effects for the two are different, and then again by combining them you can sort of take the better signal at any given time and recover your signal. Okay. Obviously this requires you to have more than one receiver, and it's mainly used for, say, base stations where you can add the equipment as you need it. Okay. So we've talked about comparing or combining these signals. There's a number of ways in which that can be done. You can just at any point choose the better of the two signals. You can try and sort of synchronize the phase of the signals and combine them then, and that combination can either be weighted or not. Okay. And so again, if you look, the idea here is that if you have a single receiver, then you're, again, at the mercy of the channel effects. At some points here, you're going to lose your signal. If you have multiple receivers, well, each one is going to lose its signal at certain points. But since they're losing the signal at different points, you can use one to compensate the other. Okay, other options are, again, try to change the frequency at which your sending your signals. And so you can either sort of just send the signal twice, or you can try something like a spread spectrum technique where you're only sending it once, but you're hoping that you only lose sort of relatively small bits of it. And time diversity essentially amounts to sending the signal plus redundancy of some sort. Okay. And so, again, there are various ways of doing that. Path diversity refers to, again, sending the signal deliberately along multiple paths. And again, then you can, if you can distinguish between the paths, you can choose sort of which is the better signal at any given time. And again, you can think of having maybe two base stations, and, you know, you'll be better able to receive a signal from one or the other at any given time. And finally, polarization diversity means, again, changing the phase of the signal. And so, again, if signals get out of phase, then you can use one or the other to recover. Potentially, you can transmit. You can have transmitter diversity as well as receiver diversity. So again, it sends the signal multiple times and hope that one actually gets there intact. Okay, so I think that's it for today. What we're going to do from now on, I shouldn't say from now on, but for the moment anyway, is, again, this is all interesting, and it's the actual picture of how channels operate and how sort of complex they are. But for the moment, just again to sort of keep the theory moving along, we're going to assume that our power attenuation is dropping just as some fixed factor of distance. So whether that's d squared or d cubed or d to the fourth, we're not going to worry about too much, but we're going to assume that there's some factor by which it's dropping and that this is very uniform. And we'll look, in this setting, we'll look at how you set up a cellular system. Now, in reality, you actually have to move a fair ways off from that to set up a real cellular system, but it's sort of the basic ideas behind it. So I'll see you guys then next Thursday.